It's Wednesday, January 31st, 2024, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Monique Luisi. On our program this week, after a crushing few weeks in newsrooms across the country, we are all asking, is journalism on the brink? And where do we go from here? Taylor Swift's boyfriend is going to the Super Bowl. Why it seems like that's the most controversial headline this week. And Jon Stewart is coming back to The Daily Show. Well, part-time at least. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to today before our half hour is up. But we're going to start with the death yesterday of Jean Carnahan, the matriarch of one of Missouri's most influential political families of the past few decades. Jean Carnahan was the first woman to represent Missouri in the U.S. Senate, appointed in 2000 to fill the seat of her husband, the late Governor Mel Carnahan, elected following his death. In her opening remarks to colleagues back in 2000, upon her swearing in, she said, quote, "I know I did not come to the U.S. Senate in the same way that you did. I did not have a long-term personal commitment to my campaign. My name has never been on a ballot. On election night, there was no victory celebration. You are here because of your win. I am here because of my loss. But we are all here to do the work of this great nation." Kathy, you were covering the Senate at about this time. Jean Carnahan had quite the impact in her 2 years in that seat.
Yeah, and that was one of the most extraordinary, her ascension to the Senate was one of the most extraordinary episodes, really, in American politics that year. It was somewhat overshadowed.
That was a big year, the 2000 election.
Yes, it was a very big year, the post-election election. But also, Jean Carnahan was sworn into the Senate the same day as Hillary Clinton. So we had two former first ladies sworn in at the same time. But what was stunning, and you alluded to it in that wonderfully eloquent quote by Jean Carnahan, is her husband died in a plane crash on the campaign trail 3 weeks before the election. There was no time to change the ballot. And the governor, the then governor of Missouri, the guy who had been the lieutenant governor who took Mel Carnahan's place because he was the sitting governor running for Senate, he told voters, if you vote for Mel Carnahan, Jean Carnahan will be your senator. So she was elected by proxy. That was a really extraordinary thing. And it's, you know, that plane crash killed not only her husband, but one of her sons. So it's hard to imagine somebody enduring that kind of a loss. One person in the Senate with whom she served who would understand that was Joe Biden.
Yes.
So I think, you know, she worked with a lot of interesting people. The other thing that I think was interesting, a lot of spouses, that's the way most women initially came into the Senate, as spouses of a member who died. When Jean Carnahan came in, I think there were only 13 women in the Senate. And so that was the typical path, but her getting there was very untypical. But she was somebody who was very accomplished in her own right.
She was. One of the things that is out there as well is that she has published 7 books, 2 of them related specifically to her life as First Lady of the state of Missouri. But some of the others, comedic books. In fact, her talent being compared to Nora Ephron or Irma Bombeck.
Yes, and she was very humorous. One of her dear friends who works over at the State Historical Society of Missouri, Beth Pike, commented on her humor, and also pointed out to me something I did not know, which is that Jean Carnahan kept what was in effect a food blog on Facebook, and I looked at it last night, and her most recent post was January 12th, and she was writing about Chinese food. So we all should be so creative and adventurous at age 90.
Women can do it all, but we know that.
And she's a perfect role model.
Yes. And in that role model, too, the first woman lost narrowly to Jim Talent in that election 2 years later, but paved the way then for Claire McCaskill in 2006.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you once, you know, for a lot of women in politics, it's a matter of there being somebody who can break that barrier and can prove that it can be done. And so she was the one who played that role at tremendous personal cost to herself. But that, I think, is the other thing that is remarkable about her. When you, I mean, a life like this that was so long, she was 90 years old and so well lived, is really more to be celebrated than to be mourned. But to when you think about the crushing blow and then her ability to come back with that and to be the humorous person that Beth Pike remembers, I think that is just a role model of resilience for people, and just a remarkable human being.
Yes.
Okay, so let's lighten things up a little bit. Super Bowl Livy, or 58. Yes, I said it that way on purpose because I've been hearing
those
that
Roman
there are
numerals.
A lot of people confused about those Roman numerals. Seeing the LV, I have to tell you, we all had that reaction because as soon as I said Livy, you should have all seen, especially those of you who are watching or listening, and you're not watching on the radio. We are not Edgar Bergen. But but for anybody who could have, if you're listening, if you could have only just seen the look on Monique's face when I said Super Bowl Livy, but Super Bowl 58. We're about 10 days or so away from that in Las Vegas. And the Chiefs are going back to the big game for the fourth time in 5 years. There's a lot for us to talk about here. So let's start with the football first. If you're CBS, how much do you like the idea of a KC San Francisco matchup?
I love it. I really love it. There's arguably some, it's kind of nice because you have the nice guys here, Kelsey, and then you have George Kittle, so you're going to have a battle of the smiles in addition to the battle of the sports. But also, these teams have fought really hard to get to where they are, and the Chiefs are now here for the fourth time in 5 years, I believe. So I mean, maybe I'm biased because I live in the area, but it's just nice to see the fandom, the excitement, the joy, and hope maybe the area will celebrate a Super Bowl win. So yes. And I think they're like the network is really liking it, and there's a certain person that might be drawing some extra attention to the Super Bowl. But I do think that that it's going to be a great game. The Chiefs have had some difficulties with some injuries. People have been questioning whether the team has been the same since some various departures. And then also with the 49ers, all the positions are stacked. I mean, you have George Kittle, Deebo Samuels, Brandon Ayuk. I mean, it's going to be pretty tough for the Chiefs. It's probably going to be a close game. That's at least where I would hedge my bets.
I love having people who know football to talk about this so I can just golf metaphor tee it up. So this is usually kind of this weird downtime for journalists, right? That week before the week before, where you're trying to still keep the excitement going, trying to find storylines. And I don't know, in other cities I've lived in, that's where you start, like during championships, that's where you start finding like the fun fan stories or kind of what's going on in preparation for or travel or ticket purchases. When you're doing this for the fourth time in 5 years, how do you keep that fresh and new?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We had a guest speaker in some of our classes this week, John Anderson from ESPN, and he alluded to exactly that, that this is the challenge, I think, for storytellers, is to find a new way to tell the same story. Now, this year, it's been alluded to already, there is a built-in new angle to the story in the form of Taylor Swift. Yeah. So I think that will add an angle, and it already has. But I think you just keep looking, and I think that's the skill of journalism. The skill is it's easy to write. It's not easy, but it's the obvious stories are the ones where you have a lead, something happened. Now you have to say, how can I take this story and tell it in a different way or tell it from the perspective of somebody who maybe isn't a natural football fan or maybe doesn't get to go to the game?
Or falls into the fandom in different ways. I'm thinking about a story that was on KOMU in the last few days about an employee there who has a Chiefs-themed chicken coop.
Okay.
Right. Y'all have brought up the trailer, right? The trailer storyline. Mm-hmm. The what is Taylor Swift going to do? The Taylor Swift's boyfriend is going to the Super Bowl. And for the early part of the season, some of those detractors were saying that she was nothing but a distraction to this team and that she was just sucking all of the air out of Monique's making the face again.
She's rivaling Ernest for faces.
She is. It's like he's here, even though he's not
it's
here.
It's his chair.
Right. Tell me what you're thinking.
Okay, some people have been referring to this as the Super Woke Bowl. And if we look at the players here in this couple, Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift, they have done things that are questionably woke, like Travis Kelce being featured in a commercial for vaccination and Taylor Swift speaking out against racism and white supremacy and in favor of reproductive rights. I think people are just mad, and they weren't mad when these issues weren't at the forefront of the conversation. But here's the thing: sports and music entertainment have long been used as platforms by celebrities to leverage civil rights, reproductive rights, gender equality, representation for persons with disabilities, the LGBTQ community. This is nothing new. So people can, in my opinion, stay mad, but it is great that we're having these issues come to the forefront of the conversation. And so we can see that sports, music entertainment, and the journalism that presents them remain a very integral part of our society to propel us forward.
Yeah, sports is, I mean, we've had this conversation before about people getting angry when NBA players have brought politics into the game. And the thing is, if you want to have athletes who are heroes, you've got to let them express themselves.
Yes.
If you look at it, you know, it's kind of funny that you say this, the woke bowl, but if you look at the couple that's at the center of this controversy, they're white from Middle America. And one of them's a country music star, arguably, or has country music chops from Tennessee. So, what's not to love, America? And so, I think the hypocrisy is what's at play here. And it's not as though either of them are leading with their political views. That's just a part of who they are. Mm-hmm. The vaccine ad is one of many ads that that Travis Kelce has made. So,
Mahomes and my auto,
right? Exactly. Yes, exactly. Are people going to get upset about that? So, I think I think this is one of these things where, honestly, a lot of the conspiracy theories and these fraught ideas. I mean, are they disgruntled Baltimore Ravens fans? I don't know.
Or are
they,
Buffalo Bills?
Or
fans.
Is it yes? Yeah. Or is it just that people are so polarized right now that they are going to find politics in everything? And the other thing I think that's a factor here is what I would call the polarization industrial complex.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people who are pushing these theories and, these making an issue of this are people who depend on generating conflict for ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of the Jesse Waters,
perpetuating conspiracy theories.
And so it's like sometimes
in their names.
Sometimes a game is just a game.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there are people who are trying to read a lot more into this just because it's going to get more clicks, more views. But it has.
But clicks and views also translate into people listening. It means somebody's listening out there, and it could translate into influence. And I think it's very scary for people who don't agree with these platforms to see these white, powerful, very wealthy, very accomplished people in positions of power. Money equals power. They're young. They have influences across multiple generations. And that in itself is enough to put fear in those who don't like the Super Woke Bowl or the Libby Bowl or the Super Bowl.
Libby. Oh, yeah, you're picking on me. Okay, fair. This next thing we're going to talk about, it almost feels like a page out of Rachel Maddow's playbook. Comedy Central and Jon Stewart announced last week that Jon Stewart is returning to The Daily Show. And this was a big surprise. He'll be back on the show starting February 12th. And like Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, will only be appearing on the air on Monday nights. But he will be serving as a producer every day. He'll be contributing in a producer role to the show through the election in November. This is kind of a big deal.
I am excited about it as someone who liked Jon Stewart. So yeah. I think this is a good opportunity to bring back maybe viewers who have since stopped watching as much, who liked his personality and what he brought to the show, which might also drive up ratings by bringing other people. I like to think of media now as just a bunch of interconnected wires and clicks and mm-hmm. tunnels. All that to say that this may be a good strategy to get new viewership by attracting former viewership, raising interest among those viewers who still have fandom for Jon Stewart, and they can introduce new people to the audience.
Jon Stewart really dominated as host of that show between mm-hmm. 1999 and 2015, through the entire Bush administration, through much of the Obama administration. And in so many ways, his show and the way that he presented and his team presented national news and specifically political news created a generation of news consumers who looked at getting news and information through a slightly different lens.
Yeah, this sword cuts both ways. I mean, I think for the current situation, it serves two purposes for both the network and for Jon Stewart. I think the network has been looking for a new Daily Show host.
They've been without anybody since Trevor Noah left in 2022.
So they're going back to an old reliable, yeah. You know, and I think Monique is exactly right. This is going to help bring a loyal audience back, and maybe they can build on that. I think for Jon Stewart, and I can speak to this because I've actually been in the same room with Jon Stewart and seen him. I remember he was at a political convention, and I had to go. I was trying to actually get an advance copy of Bill Clinton's speech that night, and his speechwriter was in the room, or one of his aides, and so I ended up in this breakfast where, as I later described it, Jon Stewart ate the media for breakfast. And it was very interesting to see. Jon Stewart is an extremely politically committed person, so and I think we all say there's a thin line between comedy and tragedy. There was a very, and it was the first time I had ever seen this, you know, he was a funny man, but you could see when he was talking to the press, and he started to harangue the press about, you know, you're not doing your jobs and both-siderism and that kind of thing. And I was really surprised. I was surprised at his level of passion. So I think for him, he probably feels, as a lot of us feel, that this is a very important election and he needs to make his contribution. So I think it's serving two sides there. But I think going back to what you were saying, Amy, he brought news to a lot of people who maybe weren't paying attention to mm-hmm, the news mm-hmm. at the time, but he did so under the guise of satire. And in so doing, and I think this may have been part of his passion, too. It maybe was a little bit of feeling of, what have I done? Because he kept saying to the reporters, I'm not a journalist. Mm-hmm. You're the journalist. You should be doing this. So he opened the door to the idea that news that really wasn't news is news. It fuzzed those lines, and I think we're still dealing with all of the repercussions of that.
And what an incredible talent to be able to translate news in a way that is digestible for people in a way they want to digest it. We've experienced in journalism so many issues with lack of readership, people getting fired, the industry being changed, people buying up companies. It's been a lot, to say the absolute very least. To have somebody who can serve as a translator in a way to bring news to people, and then somebody who's also arguably more trusted than the industry is, unfortunately, can be a real help to the industry.
It can, but then on the other side of that is when you have a political candidate saying, oh, I was just joking. Mm. When I said I was going to arrest reporters, I was just joking, or I didn't really mean that. So I think, you know, this the fuzzy line between fact and satire, it's complicated the narrative quite a bit, I think, for viewers. And, you know, to what you're saying, I sort of plead guilty to this too. I was one of those reporters who tended to write about politics like it was sports, mm-hmm. because I thought that was a way to bring people in who, and make it exciting for people who might not otherwise be interested. But that morphed into winners and losers, and there always has to be a winner and loser. And we lost the nuance.
Yeah, and in that case, if that happens, and if we don't toe the line correctly, then we all lose.
So, Monique, you were kind of saying about how we've been in this, like, reckoning, right, mm-hmm. as a profession. And the last few weeks have been brutal for that profession, of which we're a part. There were layoffs at the LA Times, Time Magazine, Business Insider, Condé Nast, Forbes. There were walkouts at the New York Daily News. I saw Al Tompkins ask from Pointer, ask a really big question in a journalism educators Facebook group. What do you say to students who are preparing to enter that profession? When we have a week or 2 weeks or a month that look like what the past month looks like, what do you say?
Well, I'm not worried about our students at all graduating and getting jobs, because they are very well prepared. And
they're going to get jobs.
Right.
They're going to
get jobs. But this is, what I am worried about is 5 years from now, 10 mm-hmm. years from now, will they still want those jobs? Mm-hmm. Because will those jobs come with a paycheck that is sufficient to support a mortgage, a family, right. you know, that kind of thing? That is my longer term worry. I think that is a problem that is not just a journalism problem. It is a civil society problem. And I think we're starting to see other people beginning to realize that. You see there's a massive move by a consortium of foundations to inject more than $500 million into local news. You are seeing, I think, some movement on the Hill where people are starting to recognize, gee, maybe I need to help my local newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I hope the wake up is coming soon enough. But, you know, we've bailed out a lot of other businesses that have done stupid things. And I think journalism has done some stupid things. But we've built out a lot of businesses that have done stupid things that had a lot less to do with democracy.
Yeah,
I'm concerned a bit for the students, because as I teach at the undergraduate and the graduate levels, I have had a lot of conversations with people asking me, how am I going to make money from this? And so they're even thinking about this before they're graduating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of students are looking at journalism, but they're also trying to see how they can integrate it with other careers, like AI and technology.
Right. Well, see, here's the thing. I'm not worried about the students because journalism is a fantastic preparation for a whole range of careers.
Absolutely.
It grounds you in critical thinking. It grounds you in good writing. You learn how to edit. You can use that in a wide range of careers. So I, you know, to answer your question, Amy, I do this in totally good conscience, because I think all of these kids will be able to support themselves. Mm-hmm. What I'm worried about is our society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If we can't retain veteran journalists to help the young ones and have the institutional memory, and I think that is a democracy problem.
Sure, but to your own point, you mentioned that you were worried if they're going to still want those jobs in 5 years. How can we continue institutional history if there is no
that's
history
exactly
that's
right.
being built?
But it's not, what I'm saying is, it's not the individuals I'm worried about. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about the social implications if those individuals switch out from a newsroom into Stratcom, into law, into any one of the number of careers that journalism can
prepare
you for.
And it does present a challenge to the Fourth Estate. There's no question that it does that. But what is our responsibility? Because I wanted to transition this conversation slightly into that idea that, and I've been in this situation professionally, mm-hmm. when the layoffs happen, when you're one of those people who is left behind, when you're one of the survivors of a round of your you're one of the survivors of a round of layoffs, the work still has to go on, the daily grind, and that leads to a tremendous amount of burnout. That's the part that drives people into thinking about moving into what I would call a journalism adjacent role, working in marketing or as a public information officer or in advertising or public relations, because some of the lifestyle changes that come with that are huge. And what can we better be doing too to help people manage the burnout factors that come with the pressures of doing this job?
I think there are two things. First, transparency and honesty about what is going on in the field.
100%.
Yeah, the field is changing. Looking at local journalists, I have a lot of graduate students who are actually interested in what's going on with local journalism. And by getting their interest in that, hopefully we can expand upon it and improve the situation. And also with the advent of artificial intelligence, virtual reality, all these different forms of media, it's going to be important that they're trained in them. Even if we disagree with how they should be used, that knowledge is important to have about what it can do, about the dangers and the benefits that these technologies afford. Second, instead of coping with burnout, we have to address the system and what within the system causes the burnout. Because if we tell people, oh, do yoga, stretch, and things like that.
You want to look at them and be like, really? I mean, yoga, and punch them in the nose. Which defeats the purpose.
Right, defeats
the
purpose.
You're not calm.
That's counterproductive to the, what we're trying to accomplish. But it's a temporary remedy, a band-aid for a bullet hole, is not going to work. So we also need to look at the aspects of our industry that are leading to burnout, that societal problem, that the big overarching issue to help current journalists and up-and-coming journalists to succeed in this field.
Yeah, I think everything you said is 100% right. I think we have to be, I think we prepare students for the world that's in front of them. One of the things I do is every challenge is also an opportunity. And one thing I can very honestly say to our students is there are many more opportunities open to them than there were when I was their age, because the news business was much more hierarchical and dominated by sort of the kind of status quo personalities you would expect. So I think letting them see that there's an opportunity to develop themselves as individuals no matter where they end up going is one thing for them. For the industry, and this is why I'm at a journalism school, I think we have opportunities here to, as you were saying about the graduate students, study what are some alternative ways of doing things that will create a new and better industry that not only serves their employees, but serves the communities better than before.
Yes. And if I may, one more thing.
Sure.
A number of students have told me, I really wish that educators would stop saying, oh, this business doesn't make any money. Ha 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 ha. It's not what people want to hear. So keep the hope alive.
Yes. Okay. Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads. That includes iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is at @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJS, Travis McMillan, for directing today's show, to Takiya Thomas for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing our theme music. Nate Brown is our social media manager, and I'm Amy Simons. We'll be with you again next week for another edition of Views of the News.